18. Recording in progress.
This is the portfolio committee meeting for public enterprises. And we've got an agenda that is not supposed to take us very long. But of course, due to some challenges with the readiness of other reports, we agreed that we need to have a briefing by the Parliamentary Legal Services on the following issues. One, how Parliament can exercise oversight over business rescue processes of state-owned companies. Two, legislation relating to business rescue and liquidation processes. Three, challenges and recommendations. Legal opinion relating to the legislative framework that prohibits state organs from collaborating or doing business together with other state entities, what we call the public partnership for the public good. Therefore, we will be engaging with this legal service. It will make a presentation and we raise all our questions. This will help us, honorable members, to be empowered to take decision in this portfolio committee based on our clear understanding of the legal issues. We sometimes get frustrated with the Treasury in relation to how business is taking place in these companies. Therefore, we need to understand what informs them and where, as parliamentarians, would be in a position to play a meaningful role in our daily oversight work. Therefore, that is essence is our meeting today. I will just, without wasting time, go to the Secretary of the Portfolio Committee, Mr. Mchumi, to provide us with the apologies. This time.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. The apologies I've received is from Mr. Kwankwa, who is attending the Chief's Forum. I know Ms. Komani is trying to log in, but is having connectivity problems, but she should be joining us shortly. Those are the only two apologies I received this morning, Chair.
Thank you.
And Chair?
Okay.
From legal services, we've got Advocate Frank Jenkins, who is the one who's going to be briefing us on this topic of today.
Okay. Thank you so much. Honorable members, I don't think we have to delay our session. We'll have to welcome Mr. Frank Jenkins, and without wasting time, to ask him to take us through. Mr. or Advocate Jenkins.
Chairperson, good morning. Good morning, honorable members. Thank you. I have prepared a memorandum for the committee, Chairperson, which I shared with your secretary. I can share that, and then if all is in order, I can proceed. So let me just share my screen. Let me just get this on. Thank you, Chair. Okay, thank you, Chair. I think that is now visible to everyone. What I'm starting with there is just a brief, and that has been read out by the Chairperson now, and I'm going to take the committee through this. hopefully in a way that can be understood. My apologies for not preparing a PowerPoint presentation. Not that I'm a huge fan of PowerPoint, but it sometimes helps. Some people prefer it. But I have the memorandum, and I'll take the committee through that, Chairperson. Chair and committee members, as well as staff, I'll start with this. What is oversight? I think the first thing, if I can start just by saying this to the committee, oversight is not a choice. It's a constitutional obligation. So insofar as a SOE, the state-owned enterprise, and I'll just refer to them as SOEs, insofar as the SOE is under business rescue, it does not suspend the obligation of a committee of the National Assembly or the NCOP if they are involved to perform oversight. So, and I'll illustrate that. We look at oversight. First of all, the committee, the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, it's a committee of the National Assembly. It's established in terms of the rules. In terms of the Constitution, the National Assembly must maintain oversight and hold the National Executive to account. So accountability is also one of the founding values of the Constitution. And Section 41 provides certain obligations for all organs of states to have effective, transparent, and accountable and a coherent government. So it all builds up to Section 55(2) of the Constitution, which is critical. And that is a clear obligation to the National Assembly. It's a peremptory obligation. The National Assembly must provide for mechanism to ensure that executive organs of state in the national sphere of government are accountable to it and to maintain oversight over organs of state. Now, one of those mechanisms is the Portfolio Committee, established in terms of the National Assembly rules, as I've indicated. And if we look at the National Assembly rules, Rule 227, it provides that the Portfolio Committee, again, must maintain oversight over the exercise within its portfolio of national executive authority, including the implementation of legislation. Now, Chair, I can stand there and just say, so when we're looking at oversight, and I'll get to the definition of oversight. Oversight, we look at the implementation of legislation. It's a very important part. And the other part, of course, I've mentioned it before, it's not a choice. It's a mandatory obligation that must be performed. The SOEs that fall within this portfolio, therefore, must be overseen by the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises. The question which was asked to our office, how must that be done? Now, we start then, there's another rule that I just want to point out there where the committee may monitor. It's Rule 2271C. Committee may monitor, investigate, inquire into, and make recommendations concerning any executive organ of state, constitutional institution, or other body or institution. So it's a very wide power to the committee to look at a SOE, whether it's under business rescue or not. When we look at the definition of oversight, in the oversight and accountability model adopted by Parliament round about 2009 and 10, it's in the AATC of 27 January 2009. It's an informal and formal, watchful, strategic, and structured scrutiny exercised by legislatures in respect of the implementation of laws, application of the budget, and the strict observance of the statutes of the Constitution. Now, if you unpack that, we can see what mechanisms can be used to maintain oversight. First of all, it's informal. So the committee may even respond to newspaper articles. It may respond to what members have seen or heard, or submissions or petitions that has been received by the committee. When it gets more formal, watchful, and strategic, we are in that instance talking about what in the department's case would be the strategic plan and the annual performance plan. When it comes to SOEs, they do not submit strategic plans, five-year plans, but they do have a business plan, an annual business plan that the committee can look at. Certainly, the issues of budget is there. Where there isn't, we'll get to the issue of so-called bailouts or capitalization of SOEs. But in terms of a department, of course, the committee looks at how the budget is spent. If it is in accordance with the strategic plan and if it's in accordance with the appropriation bill that vote that went through the committee. So that's just the general definition of oversight. Now, Chair, I just want to leave that on a pile, just leave it there for a moment, and we go to what are business rescue proceedings? Why do we have business rescue proceedings? And first of all, business rescue proceedings, as far as my experience and knowledge stress, really only came from 2008 onwards. Before that, the Companies Act, a company either succeeds or it doesn't succeed. And we'll deal with the issue of insolvency after this section. But the Companies Act of 2008 provides for business rescue. Now, rescue proceedings, I'm just trying to define it there or to give the committee an indication what it is. It's first of all, it's aimed at to facilitate the rehabilitation of a company that's financially distressed. So it's temporarily suspending the business of the company, the management of its affairs and so on by a business rescue practitioner. It just suspends it. It doesn't terminate. So there's a temporary moratorium on the rights of claimants against the company. In other words, those who have claims, the creditors who have claims against the company, those are temporarily suspended. The company's business is to an extent suspended, and then the business rescue practitioner develops and implements business rescue plan to restructure the business, to restructure its maybe its equity, its securities, its debt, and its affairs so that it can survive. So, Chair, that's in broad terms what a business rescue is meant to do. So you restructure the affairs of a company in such a way that either maximizes the likelihood of the company continue in existence on a solvent basis or results in a better return for the creditors of the company than would ordinarily result if the company was liquidated. So the business rescue practitioner, Chair, and this is important when we deal with the when we're dealing with the issue of how we're going to exercise oversight over an SOE that's under business rescue. So the business rescue practitioner is a critical person in this whole exercise. It's appointed by either one or two or more people to oversee the company during its business rescue. So it actually, now I'll indicate that later, it steps into the place of the board, although the board is not dismissed. The board is still functioning, but subject to the authority of the business rescue practitioner. So the business rescue practitioner can be a company that is involved with a kind of business like the famous Ernst & Young or PricewaterhouseCoopers or other of the auditing firms or law firms that can take on this matter. Another person that's important in the business definition of people in the business rescue legislation is affected persons. Who are affected by business rescue? Who are the important role players? Those are your shareholders, creditors, and your employees, as well as the registered trade union representing the employees. Now, these persons have various rights that I also get to. In other words, they can express or they can go to the courts to demand, first of all, business rescue. They can also prevent it from happening. They can deal with certain decisions that's been taken. So they need to be known in various decisions that is happening within the business rescue environment, Chairperson. Now, Chair, the next two paragraphs is just some statistics. Because the question was asked to our office, what are the recommendations, what are the shortcomings of business rescue? Now, Chair, that question in itself is not something our office can actually advise on. We can look at legal aspects of the legislation. But, of course, if the committee decides to have public hearings or to solicit this information from the public, what are the problems with business rescue, then one can get a sense of where the areas in legislation is that we can look at. But I've managed to get some statistics, Chair, how many active business rescue proceedings are in the country since 31 December 2021. Some succeed, some do not succeed. It looks like the majority end up in liquidation, Chairperson. Who are using business rescue? Mostly private companies. Those are the where the shares are not for sale to the public. Public companies less. And then you have the state-owned companies. We have three state-owned companies that is under business rescue supervision. So, Chairperson, it seems that it's becoming less. Maybe the business has been calming down. But those are just statistics, Chair. I'm just sharing it with the committee. I'm not really qualified to analyze it, and the time allocated for this opinion was also not necessary to look at it. And where are the issues with the business rescue? Why are companies failing to get the business rescue proceedings the result that we want? In other words, a company that's now solvent and carry on trading. But any event, Chairperson, Let's move on and let's see what happens when a company goes into business rescue. The business rescue starts, and this is section paragraph 15. Company files a resolution to place itself under business rescue. Of course, that resolution can be then challenged by the affected persons I've mentioned. An affected person can apply for the court to place the company under supervision, or a court can make such an order, and then it ends when the court sets aside a resolution of the company that placed it under business rescue, or if the practitioner that's been appointed has a plan and it's been implemented, or the practitioner decides to terminate the rescue proceedings in a court. So, Chair, that's just the duration of it. What happens? It suspends. If a company is going into liquidation and it then decides to do a application for business rescue, or suspend the liquidation proceedings, suspends any legal proceedings where claims are put against the company, those creditors, those are suspended. But of course, criminal proceedings are not suspended. The company can carry on with business, but it is subject to the authority of the practitioner. So the practitioner is really in charge to make sure the company reaches some level of solvency again. The board maintains its position, but it's subject to the control, and I've indicated that, to subject to the control of the business rescue practitioner, and the business rescue practitioner, who has full management and control of the company, may of course delegate some of these functions and powers to the board to assist him or her to perform the functions that may be done. The practitioner may remove or appoint persons for the management of the company and must develop this business rescue plan. Sir, I can just stop here maybe and say that the business rescue plan is something, of course, the committee itself is not an affected person. So the committee can't really change the business rescue plan. But it certainly can look at the business rescue plan as a benchmark to say, well, are we sticking with the business rescue plan? We sometimes hear it's not really business rescue proceedings, but when a company starts getting those perspiration on its face and it feels that it is going to go into some kind of dilemma, it usually comes to Parliament, these SOEs, with a so-called turnaround plan. And much like a committee then looks at the turnaround plan of a SOE, sometimes it's presented by National Treasury. So the committee can also look at a business rescue plan to say, are we sticking with the plan? Business rescue practitioner is always an officer of the court. So that person is subject to the ethics of an officer of the court and the duties and functions of an officer of court. So chairperson, I'm just putting there the creditors are affected person and that certain rights. I've mentioned that before. How do we then do oversight of a business rescue proceeding? So if you put that definition that I've put aside and we've now looked at what is business rescue proceedings, chairperson, how do we bring it together within the portfolio committee of public enterprises? If we look at this, Chair, I would start, my advice to the committee, we'd start with the role players. We have what we want from the SOE, from Parliament. We have, so it's business plan for the year, but now it's gone into business rescue. We can call the board. The board is always the accounting authority of the SOE. So we can call the board and ask the board why certain decisions were taken. If the board turns around and says, we are now under business rescue, of course, the committee can call the officer of the court, the practitioner, the business rescue practitioner. Nothing prevents the court from calling the business rescue the committee from calling the business rescue practitioner to say, what is being done? How long will the plan's drafting take? Is the plan ready? What's the chances of implementation? What are the chances of success or not being successful of the plan? Those kind of issues. The committee is within its powers to do that, call the practitioner or the board. If a company is under business rescue, my advice would be the practitioner is in a better position, but I'll definitely call both parties, the one being the cause and the one being the solution, chairperson, if I may make it that simple. But those are the clear role players that the committee can call. The other role player that the committee can call to find out what's happening with the business rescue in the SOE, the other affected persons, the creditors and shareholders. And Chair, I didn't mention the recognized trade unions there. I didn't have a specific SOE to work from or to use as an example, but nevertheless, the representative trade unions might also have information that can be shared with the committee to give the committee a proper understanding of the business rescue proceedings and how to have oversight over that. Chair, I want to say this again with SOEs. No, I want to say this again firstly with business rescue proceedings and SOEs. It's not an option. It's not a choice. The committee needs to continue with exercising oversight over it. And Chair, I'm sure the members and staff are very aware of the role SOEs are supposed to be playing in terms of the National Development Plan, and probably are aware of what the National Development Plan has found lacking with the SOEs, in them failing to provide proper substance or proper support for the whole idea of a development state. They're not playing their role within the development state. So exercise or oversight over these SOEs, whether during business proceeding, business rescue proceedings or not, is critical, Chair. It's critical for the National Development Plan as well. So, Chair, I was asked also about liquidation proceedings. Now, liquidation proceedings and SOEs, Chair, there's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek there. It doesn't really happen, but I'll get to that, Chair. But liquidation, in short, as you are aware, the company cannot pay its debts as they fall due. So the company can't satisfy its creditors. Either the company or the creditors then will go to court to say, we need to go into liquidation to prevent the company from getting rid of its assets, to freeze everything, and so that we can have a distribution of the available assets to the creditors and then, of course, to the shareholders. Now, Chair, just very shortly, the legislation involved there when it comes to an insolvent company that cannot pay its debts. We will look at the Insolvency Act there from 1936, as well as the previous Companies Act, which has a certain few provisions that are critical, especially when it comes to what is called the security of creditors and sort of there's a list of preference which creditors get to pay it first and which gets to pay it last. That list is, of course, changed when it comes to business rescue proceedings, because business rescue proceedings prefer to pay the wages first before we pay the creditors. Insolvency, we pay the creditors before the wages. So in short, and very general, Chair. But when a company, and this is important, Chair, because that's the basics of insolvency. If a company cannot pay its debt, you'll go to the Insolvency Act, as well as the old Companies Act, and we'll liquidate the company, and then there's a distribution through the companies, and the monies are paid out to a lesser extent to the creditors and shareholders, and that's the end of it. So Chair, a company under liquidation, paragraph 24, it ceases to trade. It's not like, unless, of course, we want to keep that company as a going concern, then there will be special provisions for the company to continue trading under the liquidator. And so forth. But the issue that I want to get to, Chair, is how does liquidation work when it comes to SOEs? Now, Chair, I just want to take the committee through what the Companies Act then provides. Because the Companies Act speaks of something that's called reckless trading. Reckless trading is when a company actually carries on trading when it knows it's not compliant with the solvency and liquidity test. That's one of the arms of the solvency and liquidity test and of reckless trading. And the responsible persons there would be the board. So first of all, what is the solvency and liquidity test? If considering all reasonable, foreseeable financial circumstances of the company at the time, the assets of the company fairly valued equal or exceed the liabilities. So your balance sheet is in order. And then you also need to go to your debtor sheet and your income sheet, Chair, and it also must appear that the company will be able to pay its debt. So it will have a turnover that can satisfy the debts as they become due, or it will have enough assets to satisfy those debts as they come due within a period of 12 months. Then a company satisfy the solvency and liquidity test. If a company satisfy the solvency and liquidity test, the directors can trade. If it doesn't satisfy the solvency and liquidity test, the directors are not allowed to trade. The company is not allowed to trade. Now, Chair, I'm just referring there to Section 22 of the Companies Act, which prohibits reckless trading. I don't really need to say more about it, but it deals with the, especially the second part, it deals with the solvency and liquidity test. When your test is negative, you're not allowed to trade. If you do trade, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission may, on application or on its own initiative, suspend the powers of that board to trade. And it might even declare you a delinquent director. Now, Chair, how do we know these things? I'm quickly going to take the committee through that. Sections 28, 29, also we can look at Section 30. These provide for your annual financial statements of a company. The annual financial statements must be audited. It must also be critically for when we're talking about SOEs, it must be approved by the board. So, Chair, when the board, and I'll use an example just to get to the point and to finalize the point, Chair. In the case of South African Airways, in 2019, it kept on trading. It was just before lockdown and so forth, and then during lockdown, it kept on trading, but its financial position was such that it could be questionable. Now, Chair, maybe National Treasury can give us more detailed briefing on this, but from the research that we were doing, as well as what the Standing Committee on Finance was doing at the time, and the information available to the Standing Committee on Finance at the time, was that the board took a decision not to approve the financial statements of South African Airways, simply because they were not, the books itself were drafted, compiled, on the understanding that South African Airways is a profit-making organization when it wasn't. And so it couldn't approve those financial statements because it was not reflecting the correct and the true nature of South African Airways. If it did approve those financial statements and it gets audited by the Auditor General, the Auditor General would have had to put a disclaimer there. In other words, whoever had some kind of equity, and that equity was just bonds, whoever held bonds from South African Airways would have said those bonds must mature now. We must get paid out because the company itself is not a going concern anymore. So we didn't get to the point where there was a liquidation application. We got to the point where Parliament could not see the books of South African Airways because we're still waiting for capitalization from the main shareholder, which was the government, the minister at that time, the Minister of Finance, and I think it's now moved back to the Minister of Public Enterprises. So, Chair, the long and the short of that question around insolvency and liquidation is that, yes, the framework is there. We have the Insolvency Act, and we have the Two Companies Act, the new one for whether it's a solvent company, the old one when it's an insolvent company. But when it comes to SOEs, usually it doesn't come into play. Usually there is some kind of support because of the issue of bonds maturing. Usually the books are held back until support can be found and those guarantees are given in the appropriation bill. And then we can continue with finalizing the books as the case was with SAA, and then an equity partner was found to make it a sustainable exercise. Chair, the last part of the brief, the so-called public-public partnerships. Chairperson, there is, in short, let me first get to the regulatory framework. For me, the regulatory framework is Section 40 and 41 of the Constitution, which provides for cooperative government. All spheres of government must observe and adhere to the principles in the chapter. And what are those principles? Those principles, Chair, I'm not going to mention all of them, but those principles of cooperative government, which again is preemptive, is mandatory. It applies to all departments within a sphere and all organs of state across the spheres of government. So they must foster friendly relations, assist and support one another, inform one another, consult one another of common interests, which common interests in the case of the brief, the public good, coordinating their actions and legislation with one another and adhering to agreed procedures, avoid legal proceedings against each other. Now, we have the cooperative government, Intergovernmental Relations Act, which deals with how certain conflict or disputes within or between the various organs of state can be resolved, Chairperson. But the question itself is there something restricting government departments or organs of state from cooperating, Chair? I'm not aware of anything. When it comes to departments, we've also seen how cabinet is structured. Sometimes a department like water and sanitation belongs to one portfolio or it gets moved to another. Environment is another example I can think of and so forth. So there's nothing at that level which prevents government departments from cooperating. Nothing prevents SOEs from cooperating with government departments or even smaller SOEs, I would say entities within the municipal or provincial sphere from cooperating with the national sphere. All of these are actually required in terms of Section 41 of the Constitution, Chair. So I'm going to leave that there. This is the end of my memorandum, Chairperson. I'm here for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Advocate Jensen. Honorable members, that is the this presentation. We will have to engage the presentation and ask questions. We contribute where we can. As usually, I will go through the list of honorables in front of me. Those who have something to say, they will continue engaging. Those who have, of course, they will say they are covered. I start with you, Honorable Dlamini.
Thanks, Chair. Morning. I don't have a question per se, but I do have a comment. I will start with the business rescue part of things. It's business rescue is not something bad. In fact, it's a positive from more especially from a labor point of view, because it seeks to prevent companies going under and people losing jobs. So it looks at how that entity can be turned around and be able to function, meaning where there are mistakes, those are corrected and lessons put in place and preventative measures would also be there. That's a good thing to happen. But with our SOEs, it shouldn't even come to a point where these entities need a rescuing, because we need to have a presentation maybe at some point that will take us through how do these entities find themselves in the situation they are in, so that when we try and discuss alternatives and find possible solutions, we know exactly what the problem is. Because we see, if you look at Eskom, for instance, it was the best run company not so long ago. But look at it now. What happened? Do we have the right people in these entities? Do they know what they need to do? And what type of effect does political interference have on the sustainability of these SOEs, if there is such? How then do we define the roles of politicians from how these boards are selected and there's too many things to mention, so that we are able to say these SOEs don't need a bailout and whatnot. That's one. In terms of public-private partnerships, there is a gray area. Because even outside of the regulation, if you look at Transnet, I wish we could get a breakdown in terms of, because look, remember, the part of their mandate is to help with the government imperatives, which include economic transformation, job creation, and to what extent do they get black business involved in their operation? A simple thing like Stevedoring. How many black companies do that? I'm not going to talk about how much they spend on black businesses, only to find out that they are using cleaning companies for catering and whatnot. So that's not the core business of Transnet, for instance. They must be able to black companies must be able to participate at the core of the business. And we need to get that type of a breakdown so that when we start discussing that, no, this entity needs rescuing, we know how money was spent and where was this money spent and what type of value was derived from that type of spending. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Gumen Dlamini. Honorable Kachalia.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question and a comment. My question is, in terms of, are we able to request interim financial statements from companies in business, SOEs in business rescue? And can we have sight of the of non-approved financial statements that are awaiting still capitalization from government or wherever? So, you know, with that caveat there, they're awaiting capitalization, I think it would help us to have sight of these annual financial statements or interim statements or non-approved statements, so that within, and even if it means within a closed meeting, we can look at these carefully. It will assist us. So that's my question. My comment is that in terms of the prevention of reckless trading, which as part of our oversight we should take very seriously, we need to, I think, question this more robustly, because in the past there have been a number of SOEs which have been happily trading, in my opinion, quite recklessly, but they've been allowed to trade until something happened, and then they finally end up in business rescue, or sometimes they don't even. So I think we need to be more robust about that. Thank you, Chair.
Oh, thank you, Honorable Kashalia. The next person would be Mawotwe / Komani. None of the two. Okay. We leave them there. We go to Honorable Piri. We don't have Honorable Piri. Honorable Butelezi. Okay, let's go to Honorable Kumede then. Honorable Sibusiso Kumede.
Chair, thank you very much. Thank you as well for the presentation. It's just a good note of peace that's presented to us. It may begin to address some of the concerns we may be having, Chair. But it becomes very clear to me, Chair, that you need a very honest board members, executive, when perhaps the root of a business rescue is opted, because it looks as if it's a process that can't be delayed. The moment in your analysis you see that the business is not moving in the direction that is beginning to, whether it loses or making profit, and then you need to come in with perhaps the process of a business rescue. The question I may have, Chair, is who decides on the appointment of the business rescue practitioner? As much as it says that person reports to the court, is it the court that gives us a person, or it is perhaps the entity or company that decides on who they want, and the court then gives the go ahead? Because it tells me, Chair, if I'm correct, it may necessitate that you need a person that may have a very in-depth knowledge of the field, as well as a person who is kind of credible in a sense, because you wouldn't like to take any person that has no relevant skills and a person who, in fact, it's not credible. I want to believe that this person may at times deal with the banks, if as much as he would be representing the entity, but he must, that person himself, be kind of credible. And another interest I may have, Chair, is I'm not sure at what stage can the process come to a halt or fail. What happens with the costs that would have been incurred, or perhaps the practitioner would have been paid in full? Is there any possibility that a process can fail in the hands of a business practitioner? That's exactly perhaps, Chair, what I wanted to find out. And what's the duration? For how long? Because this person is not gonna keep running the entity or the company. What is the expected duration? Because we may also be interested to say, with our case, how long has that person been with us? Has he over exceeded the period given, or perhaps he is still within the kind of a time frame? Chair, another question is, can the process be abused or manipulated in this regard? Because the board members are the ones who in fact come up with the analysis, as well as perhaps with the analysis, they know almost everything. If we do deal with the very sly kind of directors, they may do something which in fact at the end of the day may be their benefit. I'm happy, Chair, in the sense that, yes, it does give me a sense that it's quite correct that we are permitted to have to run or have an oversight over the business rescue process, as well as the practitioner, in a sense, because the business practitioner would have assumed the responsibility that's done by the entity. So in a sense, he is the one, whenever we need to see that person, I think, Chair, we are free to meet with that person and talk to him in a sense. Chair, the other question I may have is let me see, I've been scribbling here. Or, Chair, is a process where if it should be the business rescue and then it's the liquidation. If the business rescue process fails, possibly it will mean you now sell the assets and what for then to look after the creditor, the creditors. Then what happens, Che, when the company is already liquidated, can it then, or it can't go to a business rescue? Or when it has failed, it has failed. When it has liquidated, it has liquidated. It can't go back to a process of this thing, the business rescue. Chair, I'm happy with this. I'm hoping that Disang will in fact give us the notes. But I was interested as well on the public partnership, Chair. Because, you know, if it can be better explained, I want to say it's more the public may work better for organizations that may not be making profit, the business organizations that are not making profit. So in a sense, as much as the public, it's an alternative to, it looks an alternative to private public, because that involves money. But if you go for a public, again, it will depend on how long, there are too many contracts that are to be signed. How long will the partnership will stay before the other organization that you are in partnership with collapses as well? Because it will mean if it takes longer, the other organization must make a mechanism that it may get some people who may assist in the process. Otherwise, Chair, I'm happy. Thank you very much. Hoping Disang will then get us the information. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kumede. Honorable Isaac.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, colleagues. Chairperson, yes, Advocate Jenkins makes some very strong remarks and points out in the opening of his presentation regarding our committee that has a strong responsibility, obviously, in terms of oversight and how we as a committee can exercise our functions and duties in terms of oversight. So that alludes to a comment that was made by my colleague earlier regarding the financial statements. For example, just a few weeks ago, you would recall, Chairperson and colleagues, that this very committee deliberated over SAA's financial statements, which were some 4-5 years old, if I can recall correctly, if my memory serves me well. I think the financials were some 4 years old. Now, how does a committee, or how do we exercise concrete oversight amongst these SOEs when you're presented with financials that are 4-5 years old and expected to deliberate on them when circumstances have changed so drastically? We have a similar scenario, Chairperson, you would know very well, in Denel. We have a similar scenario in Alexcor Mining. So I think the call or the question is very valid in that, can we not have interim financials on a 12-month turnaround so that we're able to assess and do effective oversight to be able to comment as to what is really the true state of affairs currently and not deliberate over issues that have transpired 4 and 5 years ago. I just wanted to make those comments so that it can give us as a committee a stronger impetus in terms of effectively holding the executive to account. Chairperson, thank you. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Isaac. Honorable Mkwanazi.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, having done a first talk, I've been fairly covered by colleagues, especially Honorable Nasi on the issue of the role of politicians in the process, and also Honorable Gumede on the issue of public participation. My question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mkwanazi. Honorable Malinga is here? No, I don't see her there. Honorable Shabalala, the last person.
Ndori Hua, Chairperson Dimakeroni. Let me thank Advocate Jenkins and obviously the committee section for ensuring that we have this type of a briefing. I think it was quite important because over time, one, we've been making comments and wanting to understand besides what the presentation effectively speaks about our role, Parliament is fine. I think the issue of bone of contention has been this business rescue practitioner. So Advocate Jenkins, you will also appreciate there's other areas that you would have covered within the Act of Law and legislation, but there's areas that we've been making a critical observation as a committee, and I hope that the committee secretariat would have shared with you some of our concerns dated since we started the work, or rather since the matters of business rescue practitioner we have been faced with, and that started with SAA and the rest followed. Now, in your presentation 11, you know, point 11, you speak about a business rescue practitioner being a person appointed, it's a person or two or more persons jointly appointed to oversee a company during the business rescue. Now, I just want to ask there, because it also goes, it speaks about affected person. I just want to understand the person or persons appointed, who appoints them? That's something that I did not really get. Is it the same business that is going to business rescue that sees to check which persons or which company that they're going to appoint? And is there a register where they're swifted, the business rescue practitioner? We know there will be qualified professionals in different spaces, obviously, but for public safety or for public, for now, for the lack of a better word, for the mere fact that they're appointed to oversee the public entities, state-owned entities, is there such a register that they source, or they can just source anybody outside? In your report again on 13, I think it's not on 13, I think it's on 14. It highlights that as of 31st December 2021, private companies made about 69% of companies were placed in business rescue proceedings since the rescue inception. Now, 97 public companies, that costed 2%, and 3 state-owned companies, that's the percentage, were placed under business rescue supervision. And it note you want us to note that during 21-22 period, only 257 companies were placed into business rescue. And this number, obviously, you're saying is less than 370. To 3 business rescues recorded during 2019 and 2020 and 2021, and then you also highlight major provinces rescue filings occur in Gauteng and Western Cape and Mpumalanga. Now, just on that part, I think it also speaks to the question, the first question that I heard, this private and this public, and this how many they've been placed there.
Recording in progress.
Many times that these are public funds we had a situation where we kind of lost about, I don't know, what have you, billions to the rescue practitioners, and they never rescued anything. We didn't even see a part of their mandate of giving us a plan. And I'm not blaming them, but I think that we need to get some sort of an accountability, but we need to find it in the legislation where it empowers Parliament as well to oversee and have some sort of accountability method where we seek for understanding of exactly where is the funds, how did they allocate the funds to them, and how did they utilize the funds, and for what purpose. Because I think I did read in some article where you would hear business rescue practitioners themselves even appointing consultants to do this and that, and so it becomes a business within a business. But the element of accountability and how those funds are accounted for, I have a serious issue about it, because mainly they are being funded, or they are being is for the job that they're doing. But also the point of us getting value for money as part of a rescue plan that they're supposed to produce for public entities.
Recording in progress.
However, I think for me, that's where for public and partnerships as well, I think there's so much gaps. And the question becomes, how do we harmonize that and get value for money for either both? Because we lament on private, we're calling private, it doesn't come on. Public, you know, it does so many things to go to private and trying to get them on to support or to work and so forth. But we hardly to see public to public. And this issue, we've been lamenting about it. The question becomes, in this legislation that we have, is there something that can bind, that we can say and recommend as a committee of parliament, for instance, and as example, and say the NEL, for instance, that produces that used to, because the work has stopped now, produces bullets or ammunition, and then we can force police to procure from them. So that is the issue that we've been crippling with and we've been speaking about. But is there something that can really empower us? Because it only speaks to Section 40 of the Constitution, Section 41, that's where you are, and just speaks about fostering friendly relationship, assisting, supporting one another. It's a good gesture, but we want something that as public, as a PC, that we're able to pin them to do that and to kind of force them to do that. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Shabalala. I think I've finished my list. But before I give you Advocate Jenkins, you made mention that there is nothing preventing the state-owned entities working together and assisting each other. But my question is that why there is no legislation that committing them to collaborate and work together for public good? For example, if we make an example of a denial, we were informed when we were doing our oversight to denial before, when denial was already going towards the situation they are in now. And you were informed there that even the department, the South African Police Services, the South African National Defense Force are not compelled to buy, for example, bullets or to procure bullets from Denel. And they have to get it somewhere else. And Denel had a lot of staff that was abandoned there, not doing any work on simple basis that there is no client to buy their produce, while the potential clients are the state-owned entities. Dinero could have been rescued if there was law or the legislation that was compelling at least the state-owned, the public, so I mean the public enterprises, the public department, the department, and so on, to prioritize their public entities to where to buy things. They could make, they could rescue a lot, including SAA. If all the members, if all the department officials, the bureaucrats that taking flights on daily basis, commuting between Cape Town and Pretoria and so on, would have been compelled to use SAA, we wouldn't find ourselves into the quagmire we got ourselves into, where SAA ended up being forced to do liquidation. I'm just saying, what makes it difficult for these entities to be forced in a way before they go to anyway, even if it means through PFMA or what, but at least to seek procurement among themselves. Secondly, on the issue that the Honorable Chabalala raised it quite eloquently, the business rescue practitioners, I'm happy that you have been consistently insisting that oversight is not an option. It's not a choice. You know, it's not something you do because you feel like. It is compulsory. It is it's part of our legal responsibility. Now, taking into consideration of the practical experience during the SAA business rescue processes, where we find difficult to play our own oversight work due to the fact that the RP, as we were told, was not accountable to us, and we were told that they are accountable only to court. They are not even accountable or compelled, let me say that. They are not compelled to account to the shareholder, who is the main person who is responsible to finance, to deal with that department. Now, how do we reconcile those situations? That we have this legislative responsibility, but on the other hand, there are institutions or perhaps there are things like business rescue practitioners that are not supposed to account on us. Thank you, Advocate. Can you respond to those matters?
Thank you, Chairperson. And honorable members, I will do my best to respond. Maybe just in general, let me just thank the members for the questions. They're quite challenging for someone like me, but I'm going to try. I'll start in the same order as the chairperson received the questions. The first one was a comment from Honorable Dlamini. You know, the fact that can't we do something before the SOEs get into a business rescue procedure? How do we get there? What is it like? I think that question actually touches on what I will deal with. Maybe I can deal with it now, what we call the sort of in-year reporting. We know that government departments, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, must submit monthly expenditure reports, which ideally should be then used by, if there is time. I know resources are a bit strained at the moment, but if there's time and resources, committees can then do a month-on-month monitoring of the expenditure because these sort of so-called Section 32 reports get published. We also know there's in-year reporting, quarterly reporting, and mid-year reporting that is done through Treasury and which is then shared with Parliament. So again, their committees can look at that. There's thematic reporting about what the Auditor General does every expenditure within municipalities, expenditure within various areas. But so that is from Honorable Kashalia. In fact, I can go there now because that is the next question. Can Parliament request those? I don't see any limitation in terms of the Constitution, what Parliament can and not approve, other than it must be in line with its oversight responsibility. So I want to answer that question by saying that when Parliament requests interim statements, I can't see a reason why a SOE can refuse to give this. They might say, we're not accountable directly to you, but Parliament can still request it. Parliament is obligated by the Constitution, and this is why I made this point, that it must maintain oversight over these SOEs and government and organs of state in general. So pursuant thereto, Parliament may request interim statements or monthly statements. Whether Parliament will get it and the kind of kickback Parliament might receive, one might need to speak to someone, and I'm being the tongue in the cheek here, Chair, someone from the Asset Forfeiture Unit or someone like that. They probably experience this sort of pushback that one gets by trying to do what you need to do. Because when someone knows that they have done something wrong, very seldom will they come forward and hand over the murder weapon, if I can use that analogy. Very seldom will they point out where they've buried the body. Very seldom, if ever, will someone like Marcus Huister, and that's not a private company, but it had huge effects on our government employees pension fund and the PIC. Very seldom will Marcus Huister stand up and say, this is where I've committed the fraud. They will leave it and they will rely on the presumption of innocence to say, until you can find what I've done wrong, I'm not going to say and share anything with you. And you and one might get the same attitude when someone is busy with fraudulent books. If someone is not busy with fraudulent books, then I don't see a problem while sharing the accounting practices and what you've done. And what Honorable Kashali has said, that is probably will have to be considered in a closed meeting when it comes to SOEs, especially those which are listed and so forth, or which has bonds attached to them. It will have to be under, and legal services can look at that, it has to be under a closed meeting because bondholders might get nervous and the bonds might get more expensive and the contingent liabilities of government itself will be affected. So there's a knock-on effect if one look at interim statements, which paints a very bleak picture of whether a company will be able to repay its bonds as they become due. So it's probably that one will have to look at that. International Treasury probably will have a lot to say about that, so I can't leave them out of this. But the general question, can Parliament request documents to perform its oversight? The Constitution gives Parliament the power to subpoena those documents if it's not handed over voluntarily. And it can be looked at then in a closed meeting and so on. So I don't see the grounds upon which a SOE can say we're not going to share that with you. In general, there might be specific areas which are very sensitive. There might be ongoing transactions that has to do with national security. And these things might need specific advice for that specific procedure that's happening. But Chair, I'm going to leave it at that for Mr. Kashalia's question, that's on the non-approved statements. I mean, what one can do, Chair, and I don't want to get involved in policy debates, but there have been members' bills, private members' bills. I don't know if they ever saw the light, but I mean, one can bring the SOEs under the provisions of in-year reporting of the PFMA if we change the PFMA. You've asked in the brief, what are the challenges? The PFMA doesn't allow. No, PFMA doesn't require state-owned entities to report in year to Parliament or to share their strategy, the five-year strategic plans and all that. So one can look at, shouldn't we make legislation a little bit tighter to have better accountability over the SOEs. I'm just half a minute second to refer again to the National Development Plan, which has a lot to say about the role of SOEs in a developmental state in South Africa and how they're failing to do that. And certainly one can look at an amendments to the Public Finance Management Act or even to specific legislation dealing with a SOE, like Alex Corps or so forth, and to say there must be a role for Parliament and Parliament's committees, and that might strengthen it. It won't create a new right for Parliament, but it'll strengthen that right so that whoever is in charge of that SOE can say there's legislation clearly requiring that person, under the threat of criminal sanctions or administrative sanctions, to say we have to hand over interim statements, and if there are confidential issues in there, to treat it in a closed session in Parliament, Chair. Chair, I want to now move on to the questions of Mr. Gumede, Honorable Gumede. The first question, who decides the appointment of the business rescue practitioner? Chair, I want to refer to section 129.3 of the Companies Act. 129.3 provides that the company, so the company that wants to institute, wants to be under rescue procedures, the company must appoint a business rescue practitioner. But it's not anybody. It is someone that must satisfy the requirements of section 138. When one goes to section 138, I can just read that for you. A business rescue must be a qualified practitioner, is a member of good standing of the legal or accounting or business management profession, which is accredited by the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, the CIPC, and has been licensed by the commission, is not subject to an order of insolvency or anything like that, and would not be disqualifying from acting as a director. So it must be a qualified person. I'm just reading some of the issues. It's not any person, but the company appoints them. The person may be removed by an affected person, which is a creditor, employees, the trade, recognized trade union, or the shareholders. So again, that person may be removed. And there are certain grounds that can be removed. So the Act tries to regulate the appointment and the removal, as well as the qualifications and the functions of the business rescue practitioner. Chair, what it sounds like to me, and I'll get to the cost now, what it sounds like to me is that the committee has had issues with the business rescue practitioner who might have indicated that they do not account to the committee. Now, Chair, I disagree with that. I think a business rescuer, there's nothing in the Companies Act that says you account to the Committee of Parliament responsible for this portfolio. But what the Act says is you are certainly accountable to, first of all, the creditors, because we are trying to get the company back to a going concern, back to a point where there's a solvency and liquidity test has been satisfied. So to get there, we need to satisfy the creditors. So the business rescue plan itself, and that was a question that has come up later on, the business rescue plan itself must be in accordance with what the Companies Act requires. So there's a whole issue, I think it's section 150, that deals with what must be in the business rescue plan. Now, that plan must then be submitted to a meeting of the creditors firstly, and if required, also by the shareholders. But we're dealing mostly with the creditors here, because we're not liquidating yet and getting rid of the asset, the equity. We just want to get to a solvency basis, first of all, and then with the others. So the accountability, Chair, is to the creditors, it is to the shareholders, it's to the all affected persons, but the Constitution make it also to Parliament if you are dealing with an SOE. Even if you're dealing with a company that performs public functions, if we would privatize electricity, insofar as there's reticulation, as far as there's provision of electricity, and this is, I'm just talking off the hip here, Chair, insofar as a company performs public functions, and I'm thinking here of a court case dealing with the payouts of welfare payouts, where the Constitutional Court said, yes, this company is a private company registered in America, but it's performing a public function. And in as such, it's an organ of state for the purpose of that function. So even in those circumstances, there's a role for Parliament to play. We must have, as Parliament, have oversight over all organs of state. So even where there's a company that does certain things in the public, that company for that purpose and in that area is accountable to Parliament, and Parliament must maintain oversight over that company. So I find it a bit strange that a business rescue practitioner would be have a very narrow vision of it's his or her role within an SOE trying to be rescued. And maybe that business practitioner, and I say it with tongue in the cheek, but also with some seriousness, should read the National Development Plan and see where SOEs fit into the public service. And it's not isolated from Parliament's oversight. So, Chair, that is the decision. Who appoints it? The cost of the business rescue practitioner is also set out. The cost of the business rescue practitioner is set out in Section 143 of the Companies Act. It's a tariff that's prescribed, and the business rescue practitioner is entitled to that funding. If the business rescue practitioner has failed and then puts in a claim, which claim is very secure against the money of the SOE or entity that's failed, of course there can be objections against paying that, and the people that are affected, the affected persons, can bring that court application to say we disagree with the payment of the business rescue practitioner or the amount that has been set aside. So, Chair, in terms of oversight over business rescue proceedings, there the committee's role would be to ask your shareholder, have they agreed or not agreed? Did they consider the payment of the business rescue practitioner? And Chair, maybe just to point this out, and I'm not an expert on this one, so when a company, when an entity, an SOE is bailed out, it's very important for government to see, is government providing equity as a shareholder, or is government becoming a creditor by giving a certain amount of money to the company to make it a going concern? Of course, as a creditor, your equity is not improved. There might be other issues involved there, but you become a creditor. And then for business rescue practices, business rescue proceedings, it's very valuable that government is a creditor. You have more rights as a creditor than as a shareholder when it comes to business rescue proceedings. So those bonds that the government can buy, and becoming a creditor of the SOE, there might be negative consequences on the contingent liability area of the total government balance sheets, but it certainly can help with business rescue proceedings, because there the committee can ask your representative, the Minister of Public Enterprises, did you object to the payment of the business rescue practitioner? Did you object to this plan that never worked? Why not? If not, why not? So forth. Maybe there's a good reason. I'm just saying how the committee can deal with the issue. So, Chair, that's the issue of the costs. I've mentioned Section 139 of the Companies Act deals with the removal of the business rescue practitioners. Again, if a business rescue practitioner was, for lack of a better word, useless, then one can ask the shareholder, as well as the creditor, whichever part government or the minister sits on, did you or did you not become aware of this? If you did, why didn't you go to court to ask for an order to remove this person, and so forth? So, Chair, there are those mechanisms. It is all, unfortunately, sort of, if I can call it, heavy procedure, and one has to go to court. There needs to be proper decisions. This is company law. This is, of course, big money being involved, Chairperson, so one can understand. But there's work to be done, and it can be monitored. But someone needs to actually do the work. One must go to a court and say, we want to remove this person. Somebody needs to represent the minister on a meeting to say, well, we object to this money being paid to the business rescue practitioner in the cases where business rescue practitioner has not satisfied the requirements and so forth. Chair, how long was another question does business rescue take? It can take, well, I don't know I don't have experience how long it can take, Chair, but what I do know is that the Act says that it should take about 3 months to do the preliminary work. So 3 months, Chairperson, I'm referring you to Section 132.3. It says if a company's business rescue proceedings have not ended within 3 months after the start of those proceedings, or such longer time as a court on application by the practitioner may allow, then the practitioner must prepare a report on the progress and deliver the report to the court as well as the commission or the commission. Where the court ordered the business rescue proceedings to commence, or if the company did it by itself, then the commission must become aware of it. Now, again, Chair, can the committee ask that sort of progress report from a business rescue practitioner? Chair, I can't see why not. I mean, it's not in the Act there. And once again, if one asks why, or what can be done to make it to clarify the role of a committee on oversight, that is something that one can then put in there. But the Companies Act applies to all companies as well as NGOs, non-profit organizations, SOEs, public and private companies. So the question in the brief, what can be done or what are the challenges? If the challenge of the committee is that we can't get to a point where business rescue practitioners come to Parliament without being summoned, come to Parliament to give some information about the progress with SOE under business rescue, one can look at putting that in legislation, but then one will have to make it, of course, specific to companies performing public functions, companies which can be classified as state-owned enterprises and so forth, because we can't ask any company to tell us how the business rescue proceedings done if they have nothing to do in the public law or the public area, if they make purely private things and export them to other countries. I mean, one will find it difficult to find a reason why Parliament needs to have insight into what's happening there. So, Chair, that's the how long question. The question of liquidation and business rescue proceedings. As I understand it, if liquidation proceedings have been instituted and let's say by a creditor that did not get his or her money paid out in time, nothing prevents the board then to make an application or to take a vote. Have your meeting and to take a vote to place the country under business, the company, SOE, under business rescue proceedings. In that case, the liquidation proceedings will cease, will be suspended, and we will deal with business rescue. If the business rescue fail, then the liquidation proceedings will carry on again. That's how they would work. If your business rescue will really suspend liquidation proceedings. If a company has been liquidated, then it's liquidated. It's been liquidated. There's a final court order that the company has been liquidated. There's what they call a distribution account, where all the assets of the company will be distributed amongst the shareholders, creditors, employees, and whoever brought a claim against that asset. That then it's too late for business rescue. The boat has sunk. Perhaps someone can buy the empty frame and fill it again and fix it up from start, much like that can happen. I mean, we have the example of a private company, but Steinhoff, that's trying to be rescued. It's not a South African company. It's a German and Dutch company. It's different laws that apply there, but under threat of liquidation, they've managed to try to save it. So we'll see how that goes, Chair, but the liquidation gets suspended when we go into business rescue. And business rescue fails, we go back to the liquidation. The comments, I'm going to the next, Honorable Isaac. The comments on oversight of SOEs and the financials, which are so old. I think I've dealt with that question a little bit. It's about the in-year reporting. I completely agree with Honorable Isaac that it should get South African Airways accounts that are 4 or 5 years old. What can you do with it? Very little. You can look at the former board and you can say, well, the board didn't do its job. But you know, we every meeting we have as a committee or as Parliament, we're using public resources. So one must decide how to use those resources efficiently and effectively as the Constitution requires. So let's just say it's more effective and efficient to deal with a new board and what's happening now. Then those old statements have very little value. The board has not changed and we have old statements which implicates the board into reckless trading or to bad management. Of course, one can then deal with those accounts in a different way. But I agree with Honorable Isaac that we need to have the proper accounting and Parliament needs up-to-date information to deal with the SOEs. And as I say, and as one can get when we glean at the National Development Plan, the issue of not reporting on time and Parliament not getting the financial statements yet it's all public money that's been poured into the SOE. It's an anomaly. There's a failure to perform the function that they're supposed to do in the developmental state. there's a failure to report on the failure. I mean, Chair, just from a normal logical point of view, there's not going to be any success if we carry on like that. Certainly something needs to change. There must be in-year reporting. There must be accountability. So one can look at Parliament can make its own legislation. That provision or that is in the Constitution. We can make it committable to deal with these things. We can have a full-on inquiry for once based on the National Development Plan, maybe even based on other reports that are coming to Parliament or has just come to Parliament to say there are certain issues within the SOEs that allows for non-reporting that creates fertile soil for corruption, and let's change the legislation. And if the Department of Public Enterprises, if National Treasury or Department of Trade and Industry doesn't want to change the Companies Act, nothing prevents Parliament from changing that law itself so that we can have an enhanced oversight role over SOEs, Chairperson. There was just a comment from Honourable Mokwanazi. Thank you for that. Honourable McNeil, Honourable Tabalala. The specific concerns were not shared with me on why I'm doing this briefing to the committee, whether there was not a business rescue practitioner that refused to come to the committee and so forth. Those were not shared with me. But one can look at that. I've dealt with the appointment of the business rescue practitioner, who appoints, who can remove, the duration and the payment, the statistics that was referred to by Honourable Chabalala to point that some of them are not as successful as they are. I'm not paid to defend the business rescue practitioners, but of course, a ship with a hole in that sinking, you can try and scoop out as much water as you can, but you can't prevent it from sinking. So there might be instances where you can't blame the business rescue practitioner. There might be instances where you can. You can only find out if there's proper reporting. So that is where we are. But what I can say to, because the whole question in the discussion around Honourable Chabalala's input is about oversight over the business rescue practitioner. Now the business rescue practitioner and these are functions is set up in that chapter six of the Companies Act. Now, the business rescue practitioner, to earn the money, and I think they earn quite a bit, to get that money, they must have a business rescue plan, which must be approved. And what must be in the plan is set up in section, I think it's section 50, and that it must be approved, mostly by creditors. If it's not approved by creditors, sometimes it's necessary also to get certain approval from your shareholders. When we look at section 152, subsection 2, it provides that there must be a vote support of the holders of more than 75% of the creditors, 75% of the voting rights of the creditors must approve the business plan. If it fails, the Act requires that the business rescue plan be redrafted within a specific time and be resubmitted, and then different voting that can take place to get that plan approved. So that is there. It's some kind of control over it. Again, it applies generally, not just SOEs, it applies to all companies. Question is, shouldn't we do something if the committee has issues with that? Let's say the committee wants maybe not to approve the business rescue plan, because I want to be realistic with this, Honourable Chair. The business rescue plan is really to make the company survive the onslaught of the creditors descending upon the company to say, we want our money now. So yeah, if you put yourself into business rescue and you say, well, we're going to pay you a little bit later. We're going to pay you a little bit less. We're going to try and make the company work. We're going to give you some shares instead of paying you everything, et cetera, et cetera. So it's maybe not the correct place for a multi-party committee to come in, but certainly in terms of oversight, to have a view on it. I think one can say if a business rescue practitioner refuses a summons, or we can't get through the summon process, to make it clear that the business rescue plan, financial statements and so on, that Parliament committees or Parliament or the National Assembly has a right to inquire into those. As I say, it is in the Constitution, it's in the Powers and Privileges Act that Parliament has these powers, joint committees have these powers. strange that a business rescue practitioner that is so qualified in terms of the Act is not aware of that provision in the Constitution, and one maybe needs to just enlighten them if they refuse. If the refusal is persistent, then one do a summons which carries criminal sanctions if they refuse to provide us with the information or refuse to appear. So, Chair, that is that part. I want to just deal with there seems to be in the committee, Chair, we spoke about, and the brief is about public-public cooperation. And what I find is Section 40 and 41, and I agree with Honourable Chabalala, it's a good gesture. But is there more? No, I'm not aware that there is more. The sort of invisible, not really invisible, but the structures that are there, legislative or statutory structures that maybe stands in the way. You know, it's the sort of the knife has two edges argument, because we have our procurement regulations in South Africa. Now, these are structured in a certain way, and they have changed recently, and we need to relook at them after the court has declared the preferential procurement regulations unlawful. So that happened last year. I don't know if the new ones have been approved yet, but we're back to the 2017 regulations now, I think. Now, Chair, those regulations provide that a organ of state or a department must have a procurement process, and that procurement process might then turn out to be such that the bullets from another company is cheaper than the ones from Denel, and that might be an obstacle. But there are provisions within that law which says you do not have to take the cheapest option. You can take another option for other reasons. There's also now new provisions which has now been struck down, not those specifically, but where it can be that you have preference for local manufacturers and so forth. So those kind of issues are there. It will be interesting to find out what the reason for those in management of SOEs, what their reasons are for not preferring locally produced goods or goods produced from SOEs, and to use those rather than to use others. I mean, because it's in those decisions where a lot of money is involved that you start getting strange decisions, if I can call them that, and which are then sometimes reflected or not reflected in statements, as well as in audit reports about irregular expenditure, Chair. So that is, you know, the question Honourable Chabalala asked, is there something more to force the public to cooperate with the public entities? There's nothing that I'm aware of. In fact, what we have there is to say we need to keep economics, we need to be alive to the economics, we need to have procurement systems that prefer certain point systems. So that is there. I find maybe some of these things are being abused. I don't know, I'm not an expert on that. I'm not in the practice there, so I can't really comment on it. But one must just remember that those things are there before one jump to the point where we say, okay, well, let's force, Chair, I'm going to get to your question because I think I'm sort of, it flows naturally to your issues. For someone to procure amongst themselves, and what steps if the point is, I can't really comment further on that, because if everybody is required to fly South African Airways, then one must see South African Airways providing the best service for it and the best price for it. Not everybody needs a full meal flying from Cape Town to Johannesburg. Not everybody needs exactly what is there. Some airlines do it at half the price of South African Airways, and these are the things that one must then pick out. But, Chair, as you're very well aware of, many countries have done this. Many countries, and I think the Ethiopian Airlines were one of the first who started with that, to say we will use Ethiopian Airlines within Ethiopia. This was before the war, and the war has ended now, so let's hope that they can get back and get their airline back in shape. But the question is that what they have done is maybe something we could learn. How do you use your airspace to ensure that there is a social economic development within the country? And I think that was your question. As I said, there's other market forces involved, and our procurement regulations at the moment does not prohibit it, but some people might use it to favor other suppliers. There's always a choice that they can have. And Chair, your second question was about the rescue practitioner. Is it accountable to the portfolio committee? Chair, I think that question needs to be solved, and the business rescue practitioner needs to be on the same page there. I can only compare it, Chair, to to what's in the Income Tax Act, as well as in the, I think it's the Revenue Laws Administration Act and so forth, where certain bodies, regulatory bodies, have access to data of taxpayers, and Parliament doesn't. So when Parliament wants to do, let's say, an audit, a lifestyle audit or an audit of a company or of a business, we cannot require, we can't request their tax documents because we are not listed there. So they will have a legitimate objection to say that in terms of the Act, you cannot have our tax details, even if you treat it confidentially. Now, that's not the case with financial statements of SOEs, but the answer on the tax issues as well as SOEs is the same. Put you on the list then so that you remove all kind of doubts. But the doubt should not be there in business rescue practitioners, but with when it comes to tax, of course, that we need legislative change. Chair, I think I've dealt with all the questions. If there's something I left out, I'm still here. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Advocate. Honorable members, if one would love to to ask the last or a follow-up question quickly, we have a few minutes. Can somebody indicate, okay, one, there's one. Is there any other person?
Yes, sir.
Two. Is there any other? Well, I won't give somebody who's going to come without indicating now, because I'm also looking at my watch here. I don't want us to. Okay. Let me start with you, Honorable Kumede.
Chair. Yes. There is a question I asked that can the process be manipulated or abused? Did you get my question, Chair? Chair?
Yes, I'm listening to you.
No, I was saying I asked a question whether can the process be manipulated or abused?
Yes, I got the question, Chair. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Honorable Shabalala.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Please be patient with me, even Advocate Jenkins, because I think this is an important briefing. And I think perhaps because part of our lamentations that we've been having, we've always asked that we needed to have a joint meeting with DTI. Now, my question is a follow-up to the same question that I asked Advocate Jenkins. I wanted to ask, as much as a business rescue practitioner, the act that governs it under the, besides the court one, I want to, the Companies Act, and because that's where you find the business rescue practitioner. So I wanted to ask, who is then responsible for this legislation? Is it the DTI? You've made some, you said something about as members of Parliament and as portfolio committee, we can go to Parliament, you can do private members bill, what have you. But I'm just saying to tighten this area that we're having so much concern. And I also would want to employ you, my Leonard friend. I know you've been in the establishment for a very long time. So because you keep on making reference that you might not be an expert in this field, that perhaps part of what we need to take is moving forward as part of recommendations that you might want to go back again, so that also the committee section will still look at it, the best way how we can handle these gray areas that we're thinking that are very important. And I'm going to illustrate why I keep on making reference that accountability here is an issue. The issue is not just about you come tell us what your work, what you are doing, account, However, you cannot hold them accountable because they go to the Master of High Court. That's where they account. And so far as the public funds, my issue is on the public funds that funds them. There is the same entity that appoints them, that's what you said, but then accounted to that entity. They themselves, the department came to us and told us business rescue practitioners don't account to them. And that's where I literally pick up an issue with that, because then we don't have a way of accounting to the money that we would have allocated, or rather to follow the money thereof. And that's my issue. And let me illustrate other points to that matter, is that, you know, business rescue practitioners are practitioners, right, that are appointed, like you said. Now, in 2021, that's where we had an issue with a person by the name of Mr. Sivuyo Dongwana, who, you know, kind of avoided accounting to Parliament on the airlines business restriction. That's where we're dealing with the SAA. And that was in 2021. However, that changed because we had an engagement with SAA, things was on SA Express with the business rescue practitioner later. And it's reflected in our minutes and even in our recommendation. And then that's when we were able to have, but it was right late now. It was even at a point where we're getting rumors that SAA has been sold for 51 rand till today. I still don't understand the interpreting this thing of 51 rand that has been sold, SAA sold, beside the assets and other things that we needed to dispose. Hey, I still have a problem. I've not woken up from that nightmare, and I don't even know the of it, and it's so unfortunate. And that's where I want to come, because we need to find a value for money that would have given business risk practitioner based on their work and how they are appointed, to make sure that we might not find ourselves ending up to that. Not because we didn't want, and so let me leave the politics of it. Now, Chairperson, the in terms of Section 143, the business risk practitioner, It's. I'm trying to check how much they get entitlement to charge a company, you know, for their remuneration expenses incurred by practitioner in accordance with the tariffs prescribed by the Act. And that's what we're told. I remember in the other meeting we were with them. And that took to 2,000 per hour. That takes you to over a maximum of 25,000 per day, including of it at a large company or state-owned company. So that's how much we're paying. I don't want to say losing, because then when I say losing, it just sounds like something else. But there was this matter of SAA, because we tried to solicit to say, how much have you paid this business rescue practitioner that doesn't want to come in account? And we're told that was 2022 now. Business rescue practitioner were paid over 36 million. That was in June. And this is money that even us as Parliament, that we can't say that we understand what they were used for exactly. Now, the business rescue process, Chairperson, in effect, it's duty. It's supposed to protect the company assets against creditors, like Advocate Jenkins was saying, thus preserving the value of the company, business, and assets. And the imposition of a moratorium, stay all claims, and so forth. Have the combat business rescue done that with the sale of with SAA? I beg to differ. Part of other responsibility is to allow employees to continue to be employed in terms of their employment contracts. Did they do that? I still beg to differ on that. Oh, Chairperson is talking. Are you stopping me? You're talking. You're muted.
Wrap up.
Oh, I must wrap up, ne? Okay, Jim. All right. I was kind of interested in the discussion, but let me leave it at that and say, perhaps, Chair, what we need to do is to ensure that we kind of continue with this process of this discussion until we understand it, until we get the type of accountability that we really need. I, for one, the fact that Mr. Damara and so forth, and what we saw with SA Express, where practitioners was paid to 691 million in the form of government guaranteed. And when SA Express was under provincial liquidation, that was in 2010. So let me leave it at that. All I'm saying, Chair, we still have to go a bit of a mile on this issue because it's impacting on us, and so that we're protecting other SOEs that will find themselves in this business rescue. Lastly, to say, this practitioner's chair, is there a kitty where they are sourcing them? So that we are checking how much they rove around the states and how much they're really assisting, because I don't see them assisting. But these are serious monies that we're losing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Advocate, I think you will have to wrap up, but in your final response now, on this public partnership matter, the Competition Commission seems to be anti-competitive behavior for SA, for these state-owned entities to show preference to each other. They're apparently not comfortable with that. Secondly, including the National Treasury also frowns on the state-owned entities showing preference to other state-owned entities. I think, I don't know whether that should be us as politicians to start engaging around the changing that kind of a behavior from both Treasury and Competition Commission, or perhaps it's only courts who can help us there. Can you advise us there? Because as long as these state-owned entities are not compelled in terms of legislation to help and assist each other to improve their financial muscle, we will never move. In fact, I still had an attitude that perhaps the PFMA itself is not intending to help these entities out of corruption, because the preference of private enterprises is where these bureaucrats are being corrupted, actually. And they are corrupted because they've got these kickbacks that they cannot get in the public-public partnership. Can you help us there? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll wrap up, and I'm trying to help there, but I'll get to that. I think that actually speaks to the first question that you took from Mr. Gumede. Can the process be manipulated? I would say yes. As it stands at the moment, it can be manipulated. I think there can be additional checks built into the process. One of them is to report to Parliament. The issue of Parliament reporting, I say this with the utmost of respect to the committee as well as to the houses, is not necessarily that Parliament is the best place to make decisions, but Parliament is a transparent forum for the consideration of national issues. It's probably one of the only constitutionally mandated transparent forums in this country that says what comes here is open and accessible to the public unless it's reasonable and justifiable in a democratic society to exclude the public. And therefore, the public can challenge that test, whether we've met that test. So, Chair, the process as it is at the moment with the company not being able to pay its debts, putting itself into business rescue. The company then appoints a business rescue practitioner that must comply with the act and that must be certified. Now, can that be manipulated? Yes, that can be manipulated. You might have a person that used to be at that company that's now there. If it's not known, then it can be manipulated. Chairperson, how do you stop that? The creditors must stop that. The shareholders, the people who are affected by business rescue, they have got the rights in terms of the Companies Act to change the business rescue practitioner or to object to the funds being paid to the business rescue practitioner. So it is not a direct link to the portfolio committee. And I'm just touching on something that Honorable Chabalala mentioned. The committee needs to deal with the shareholder or the creditor, which is usually represented by the Minister of Public Enterprises. It used to be the Minister of Finance in one or two SOEs, but usually it's the Minister of Public Enterprises. That person needs to account what has that person done in the capacity as shareholder or as creditor of the SOE vis-a-vis the institution of a business rescue practitioners and so forth. So I understand that one will get from a business rescue practitioner that you can't finalize this. If it's a big company, you can't do this in 3 months. South African Airways can't be fixed within 3 months, just like say generally, and they need more time. And then the Act will provide that you can go to court or you must go back to the company and get extension. The fees and so forth needs to be looked at. Again, there, the oversight is not directly over the fees, but over the shareholder or specifically the creditor. Did the creditor stand up in the meeting to say they object to these fees being paid? Now, the fees, of course, it's not to one person. A business rescue practitioner might be a person, but that person is supported by a whole administration that looks at all areas of the company. They need to go through the books of the company. They need to find new solutions. They need to negotiate with creditors or shareholders how to rescue this company. So the money is not just focused on one person. It is bigger than that. So one needs to look at it, Chair, but certainly to look at the Companies Act, Honorable Chabalala, the top Department of Trade and Industry is in charge of the Companies Act. So one can look at them or have a meeting to see if the Companies Act can be amended or should be amended. It's a policy question to deal with the gray areas that you mentioned. And then, Chair, your question, the showing of preference, which is not really to the liking of Treasury or it's against the law, according to the Competition Commission, Chair, those are discussions one must have, Chair. I mean, if the result of SOEs colluding, if the result of SOEs working together ends up in collusion, then you are minimizing competition, which goes against the philosophy of business within the country, in our country, in any of it. So the collusion mustn't come. There mustn't be price fixing. This is what the Competition Commission is worried about in general. If there's cooperation without fixing prices, but cooperating to actually bring down prices, but not to exclude other persons in the market, to exclude other market players. That's what the Competition Commission wants to see. They don't want the exclusion of competitors. They don't want collusion. They don't want price fixing. So I think that the way they've dealt with it, when we say SOEs, let's work together. If it suddenly becomes a matter of collusion, then the first question that Honorable Gamede has asked has been answered. Then there is kind of manipulation of this sort of noble, this grand idea of cooperation and cooperative government. And the only way to deal with that, Chair, is to have it in an open arena, to have the sun shining on this information and the public and the media looking at this information. And you get all kinds of people. We've even seen with the Zondo Commission, we get members of the Houses of Lords coming to South Africa to say, we want to have something to say about this. We know something about what's happening here. So that's what Parliament's role is so important in these matters. Sorry, Chair, I can't say exactly what Treasury or Competition Commission's issue are, but the way that the cooperation is happening, it sounds like it turns into collusion or price fixing or exclusion from the marketplace. And that's a worry then. And for those things to be dealt with, the committee needs an open process where everybody participates, especially the smaller businesses, which feel that they are being excluded and they're not getting government contracts, Chair. I see we're out of time, so I'm going to wrap it up there, Chair. And I'm here for further questions if there's time or for another engagement. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Advocate Frank Jensen, for your availability to take us through on these the difficult issues. We hope that honorable members at least have learned a lot from your input and from your poses, not easy questions, and something myself. You have assisted me, you have empowered me, and of which I think all other members have been empowered about these technicalities. We would love to also to have you again when we have a need to be helped to deal with the issues of this nature. We thank you very much. you can be released. Advocate, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I will log out now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable members, we supposed to be getting into the second point in our agenda, which is the minutes of the previous meeting. I would like to start to ask the secretary of the committee to take us through.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Yes.
These are minutes of the 2nd of November, Chair, which was an engagement with Eskom Board on the energy crisis and Quebec-related issues raised by the NUM. The meeting was attended by the board of the chairperson of the board of Eskom, the CEO and the CFO. The first point basically is the introduction. The second point being the input by the chairperson of the board of Eskom and his introductory remarks. And the 2.1 deals basically with what Eskom had actually presented, not in detail though. And then just a few of the issues that were raised by the committee in terms of the discussions. And then also a brief response by Eskom. Apologies for that, Chair. The thing, yeah. And then those were the issues that were raised by the committee. And then in terms of the resolutions, the committee wished the board well in this term of office and pledged to exercise its robust oversight over Eskom to ensure that South Africans has a reliable and affordable electricity. But it was a joint meeting with the Committee on Energy and Mineral Resources.
Honorable members, that is the presentation. Can we adopt the minutes?
Just amend, please, my right at the top. My name, my initial is G, not C.
Okay. Please, can you correct that, Mr. Muchumi?
Noted, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Kachalia, are you adopting therefore with that amendment?
Mkwanazi. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, Mkwanazi adopting. Is there any seconder?
Dlamini second.
Dlamini seconded. Thank you so much, honorable members. Muchumi, is there any other?
Yes, Chair, there's a minute of the 26th of October, Chair.
Come in.
These are the minutes of the SAFCOL annual report and financial statements. The leadership of SAFCOL was led by the Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises and the CEO of SAFCOL. Then the first part is the introductory remarks of both the chairperson and the Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises. And then number two basically deals with the synopsis of what the SAFCOL annual report and financial statements for 2021-2022, and then a summary of the discussions and issues that were raised by the members, including the responses from the SAFCOL leadership. And then the resolution being that the committee needs as resolved to actually have a, there's a need for a visit to SAFCOL head offices in Johannesburg. And also it resolved to defer the minutes for that particular day. It is on the day when Yandi so actually assisted me with the minutes. Thank you for that. I was writing an examination on this day. Thanks, Chair.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mutumi. Is there anyone to adopt the minutes, honorable members?
I move.
Kumete, seconded by Mkwanazi. Is it correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Those are the minutes. Is there any other thing, honorable, Mr. Mutumi?
Yes, Chair. I thought maybe the issue of the program, we had to apologize to the members because we had to reshuffle the program because most of the companies that were intended to invite had not yet tabled their annual reports for this for the financial year. Hence, we had to bring forth some of the issues that we had raised, we put in our program for later in November. So we are hoping that by we will send a revised program to the committee.
Okay. Thank you. Honorable members, thank you very much for your participation in today's the portfolio committee session. I think we reached the end of our meeting. The meeting is officially adjourned. Thank you.
Recording stopped.